There's no middle ground. It feels like everybody has to use the most extreme version of whatever it is that you're talking about. Rape or sexual assault is also a really good one. There are no more bad sexual experiences. They're all rapes or assaults. There's no more
bad
asshole
dates.
Boyfriends. Yeah, there's abusers or manipulators. There's no more he lied to me. It's he gaslit me. There's no more. Yeah, like it's everything has just gotten so extreme. But it's like,
I do think there's a kind of, and I do think there's a kind of social media exacerbates and amplifies the virtue signaling behavior, mm-hmm. the virtue signaling verbal behavior. I just wrapped up a fascinating conversation with Destiny, a very popular YouTuber and commentator. We talked about ideology, beliefs, the United States, world politics. We interrogated each other's beliefs. It was a wonderful conversation, and I had a great time. I hope you enjoy it. Steven, aka Destiny, thanks for coming down and talking to me in Miami. Appreciate that.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. So I have a bunch of questions that I've written out. I want to just throw them by you. Things that I've been thinking about and I've been curious about. Why do you think, or do you think that people on the left won't talk to other people? If so, why? Like publicly talk to people?
I think there's a couple different parts of a left versus right belief system that can play into people's proclivities to talk to each other. So for instance, on the left, you've got people who talk about like the paradox of tolerance, to where if you're tolerant of viewpoints that are very intolerant, then you run the risk of those particular viewpoints becoming so popular that it basically bullies out all of the tolerant ones, because intolerant people try to get rid of tolerant people, basically. Yeah. That's an idea you have on the left. I will say, though, that there are similar types of ideas that show up on the right. So, for instance, the biggest arguments that people on, I don't know if I'd say far right, but like very religious right will give against LGBT stuff as well. If these LGBT ideas become really popular, our kids are all going to become trans, and then we're going to lose the culture war that way or whatever. Yeah. So, honestly, at the end of the day, I really think that, I think that if you have a lot of power, I think that the more power you have, the kind of the less you're into the whole freedom of speech and talking to people that disagree with you, because you don't need to. You already have like the majority cultural power. So I think as of recently, you've seen kind of the left has more cultural power than the right, at least in terms of like media and schools and everything. So why would they want to give the right a platform? And now the right is very big on like freedom of speech and everything. Yeah. Even if they go back 20, 30 years ago, they wanted to censor all the LGBT stuff, get rid of like violence in video games, get rid of all the stuff that offended them. But now that they're on the back foot, they're like, well, no, actually everybody should have freedom of speech.
So you don't think there's anything intrinsic to the ideology that causes people like with identitarian concerns to not talk to other people? You just think it's who's in power?
As I've gotten older and as I've gone through more and more of these, seeing like the come and goes of different types of political ideologies, I'm less feeling like there's stuff intrinsic to political ideologies and more that political ideologies just tend to be the manifestation of a bunch of really similar foundations of belief from people. That's like the feeling I have.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you're the incumbent in a presidential race and you're way up in the polls, you don't want to have any debates. Mm-hmm. If you're way down in the polls, you need more debates.
Yeah.
So I think there's a similar principle operative there about having the power. It does seem to be something particularly intrinsic to the left. I mean, it's certainly intrinsic if you look at the ideologies that underlie it, the academic ideologies that buttress it or underlie it. But I do find it concerning because we have an impossible time to get people who are proponents of critical social justice on the show. Like it's they just won't come on. And the consequence of that is people always accuse us of being like, you're not inviting them on, the emails got lost. I mean, it's insane. So how do you talk to those people or no?
No, they don't talk to me.
why don't they talk to you?
I think that depending on how far left you go, you're getting into like academic circles and stuff, and they just don't talk to many people at all. If you're talking about like the big shows, I don't know. I just don't think people in big shows in general have very many combative conversations or very many adversarial conversations, because it seems like kind of what you just said before, the upside is almost non-existent. Like, okay, well, I can talk to a person and I guess I can get some views on a video. But the downside, if you do really poorly in a conversation, is almost unlimited. You can have a conversation that ends your career, technically, if you have it horribly enough. So yeah, I mean, on the left, on the far left, it's hard to find people that will have those conversations. But I mean, on the far right, like how many earnest debates does like Ben Shapiro do, where it's like a hardcore debate against somebody, or like even a Steven Crowder or even a Jordan Peterson? Like these people aren't generally having like hardcore debates. They do step out sometimes, but you know.
Yeah, and it bothers me when I go to the conferences, the quote-unquote anti-woke conferences, it bothers me that they have panels in which everybody is agreeing with everybody else in the panel. It bothers me. So I think this is really important. I am completely, not only am I sympathetic, like I get it, I grok it. I completely understand that you can't get people who are identitarians to come on and speak at your conference, and you can't have debates. Like, I get that. But why can't you have people steel man those positions and say, look, this is the quote-unquote good faith representation of these positions? I don't see that. I see these as forwarding anti-woke ideological narratives, many of which, by the way, in my experience, have been Christian nationalist in its origin, in its orientation. But I do see these competing echo chambers constantly branching out with ideological conformity baked into the system, and I find it incredibly disturbing.
I think that for a lot of people, the vast majority of people, it's probably just part of the human condition is you inherit a lot of the applied moral positions and applied political positions of the people around you, and you don't actually do all the work to think from, here's
for
my
sure.
moral foundation, here's my epistemic, whatever, and then I'm going to have like an applied, you know, ethical position or applied policy position. You don't really do that work. You just kind of inherit it from the people around you. And I think one of the consequences of that is an applied political position becomes a replacement for foundational moral statement.
So 100%.
Yeah. So if I say like if I say that I believe that a certain people are like either committing genocide, or if I say a certain group of people are like against rent control, what I'm really saying is that like I just don't like what these people are doing because it breaks away from my applied position. So then if you have another person who's against your applied position, they believe something different, it might be something like minimum wage. You're against minimum wage and they're for minimum wage. Well, it's because they hate business and they hate people and they want everybody to fail because you can't even conceive of a different foundation of a belief when you don't have a foundation for your own beliefs.
Yeah, and that's why one of the things that I've learned over the last 15 years, I've been acutely aware of the role that community plays and how people want to maintain their relationship. It's somewhat related to audience capture, and it's somewhat related to we want to belong, we want community, we don't want to go against the community, we want to all kind of, you know, rah, have our own champions. And I think that is a recipe in philosophy called doxastic closure, or, you know, closing or constricting one's beliefs. It's a kind of moral strangulating people morally as well. So let me just, I'm curious about a few things. So,
I will say on that, just because... Like, it's not necessarily a bad thing. You can imagine that you probably need some level of ethical cohesion or even factual cohesion for groups of people to operate together, right? Like, you don't want a guy in the group that thinks it's okay to have sex with children, and you don't want a guy in the group that thinks it's okay to steal all your shit, and you don't want a guy in the group that thinks it's okay to take a shit in your cereal, right? You're going to need some collection of, like, beliefs that all of you guys agree
commit
with.
Commit social right? justice in the cereal.
Yeah, you have to have an agreement here, but the problem, I think, is that the groups have gotten so huge that now the teams that we belong to can't possibly accurately, in a healthy manner, represent what we should feel. Like, if you go to a particular neighborhood, you're going to find a lot of cohesion there, but when you try to say like everybody across the country, like you're a worker in a warehouse in Louisiana, and you need to have a really strong opinion on Leah Thomas, or you're a guy that lives in Bakersfield, you're in Central California, but you need to know everything about AOC. Or it's like now the groups are so huge that all the ideological conformity across so many different people, I think, is like really destructive.
So I'll push back on that, because even if that is operative in these large scale communal. To have group cohesion, that you need some ideological positions around which one marshals, that shouldn't be the case, or maybe it can be achieved differently if at conferences you had representatives, the best representatives, not morons, like the best representatives of people who disagree speaking, and then you have some kind of dialectic in which people engage. And it's that process that I don't see. And it's that process that bothers me deeply, because it's unclear to me how those people could know if they had the truth. The only way you would know that, you need a corrective mechanism. Like, you
need
some way.
Why does it matter if you have the truth? Who cares?
Well, I guess it depends if you don't care about the truth. What role you? I guess it depends. It's not bad at all if you're honest about it and say, I don't really care what's true. I just want to be a hedonist, or I just want to live my life the way I do. But I think it was Hannah Arendt who said, the very fact that one possesses an ideology means that the things within that ideology, they believe those things are true. And so you, at the end of the day, unless you're explicitly not making truth claims like many of the postmodernists. But even the postmodernists, they're not claiming that the world doesn't exist. They're just claiming that those power structures mediate the relationships and how you understand what is true. They're not repudiating, most of them, some radicals are, but they're not repudiating the notion of truth entirely. So
I think that when I think of truth to an individual for how humans exist, I view truth as way more of an instrument than an actual like end goal in and of itself, which I think is sad. I think there should be some adherence to figure out what is actually true and whatnot. But I think that truth and the way that people approach it is usually just a way to reconcile cognitive dissonances. And as long as a particular set of facts is serving your purpose, yeah, people's adherence is going to be way higher to things that satisfy your baser Maslow's hierarchy of needs than like strict adherence to some, you know, being epistemically humble and trying to pursue truth as much as possible. Because at the, like, I remember I used to say things where we would argue about things like religion, or we'd argue about like certain social values. And be like, I don't know why you would ever like not feel strongly about this particular thing.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Okay, yeah, sorry. Yeah. I like to ground out in real examples. A lot of people complain about having their family member or family members not accept their significant other. Mm. And in my mind, that's impossible. Like if I ever had like a mom or dad that was trashing my significant other, I would just never talk to my parents again. Like that's an easy choice for me. But I realize in saying that and reflecting and then in talking to a lot of people, just arbitrarily cutting out your family or cutting out your family because they don't accept your partner, that's a really hard thing for a lot of people to do, especially if you still live with them. Like if you're college, you still live with them, or if you're in high school or whatever. So I think a lot of people will try to maintain adherence to like the social groups that they're in to kind of make their life function and work, rather than I'm going to go live and be homeless if that's what it takes for me to adhere strictly to the truth. You'd rather accept a couple other things to have that acceptance with a social group than to commit to like the most hardcore radical truth-seeking pattern you can have. Another great example, this is the internet.
Hold on.
You can always cut me off.
There's so much there.
Go.
Can I ask you personal questions?
Yeah.
Are you close to your parents?
No, not as much, okay, which is why I'd say, well, let me be very clear when I say that. Right. I love my mom and dad a lot. I love them a ton, but I'm just like kind of distant from a lot of my family.
Yeah. And do you think that is the reason that you would defer to your relationship as opposed to your parents' approbation of that relationship?
I mean, I hope not, but it might be. And I just don't, I'm not aware of it. Right. Like I would hope that even if I had a strong relationship with my family, if they were trashing a significant other, that I would say, well, no, that's not acceptable. Like if you're going to keep doing that, I'm going to choose my partner that I chose. But I mean, who's to say, right?
What if they were trashing your significant other because they thought she was bad? You're straight, right?
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they were trashing the, because they thought it was bad for you.
That's different. That's not what I'm talking about. Oh, I mean, like they say, I don't mean that they're like, this person is like trashy and like you can do better. I mean, like they're like racist, or they're like, I don't like your significant other because like, I don't like what their parents
are. Okay, those are red lines. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so that view of truth that you exposited there, that's to me, that's an instrumental view of truth. Mm-hmm. I do not possess, I think Peterson kind of possessed that, you know, the mean thing. I do not view that at all. I think that there's something that enables you to get through the day like that. And there's something, I think that the force of evolution in general, we haven't evolved to be truth-seeking beings, we've evolved to understand conditions and through natural selection that enable us to procreate.
That's really important. I got a lot of boos at audiences when I say that, but humans are not truth-seeking machines at all. That's a very unnatural, there's a lot 100%. You have to unlearn, right? 100%. When you do philosophy, the whole goal is to make almost everything queer and alien to you. It's like, what the fuck? I don't understand how, like a lot of that building block is peeling back all of the initial biases you have. And a lot of people have a hard time accepting that. Like the example I was gonna give earlier was like the internet. People thought that when the internet came out, holy shit, everybody's gonna be a fucking genius. We've got all the information everywhere. When in reality, you see that truth as an instrument. Well, now you have the ability to find whatever truth you want, whatever actually fits you the best. And it's unfortunate, but.
I think by and large, you really, how old are you?
35.
I've had so many people say to me that, I hope you don't take this the wrong way. I've had so many people say to me that you're like a younger version of me.
Okay.
Has anybody said that to you?
I've heard people overlap our stuff a lot because of the epistemic exercise you do with like college students and stuff.
Oh yeah, the spectrum street epistemology. Sometimes when I listen to your conversations, I think that a lot of that stuff can be cleared up. Like if you look at this as a cognitive or epistemological intervention, to just say to somebody right in the beginning, okay, like, how important is truth to you? And then like frame the conversation around what is true, and if they want to know things that are true, And that will cause them to shed some of these sclerotic notions of, oh, you know, I have to adhere to this belief because it's a community. I have to, like, you know, be very recalcitrant when it comes to this. But I think in the context of a conversation, when you frame it around what's true, you can cut through a lot of the noise. And then be off and running. I'm just thinking of the conversations I've had with people about religion, about, because when we do the spectrum street epistemology, we're going after the sacred cows most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree that there's verbiage you can use, and there's a way that you can set somebody's mind to start thinking about things a bit more critically.
Yeah.
Because people are very intelligent. Like your brain is a wonderful machine, and most people have, you know, causal, deductive, they can follow the stuff. Most of what makes it difficult is to pull somebody away from all the other junk that's making things, like, really confusing. An example I bring up a lot on stream is, for a while I started betting people on their beliefs, because I was like, okay, well, if you believe this, you're telling me that you feel 99-1. You're 99% sure this is going to happen. Okay, so then if I bet you $100, you should be willing to stake, you know, $99,000 against me.
Right.
I'm very confident. I expected one of two things to happen. I expected people to tell me to fuck off, or I expected people to maybe take, like, really bad bets because they were way overconfident. But a third thing happened a lot that was really surprising.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
They accepted?
No. More surprising than that is they started to hedge incredibly appropriately. I had a conversation with a guy before, and he was like, oh, no, Trump's going to win 100%, this blah, 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 blah. And I offered. I was like, okay, you're so sure. Like, I put money in the election. Sure. I bet money on my button. Yeah, I'll bet like $500. What, are you going to give me odds? Because you're so sure, right? You give me 10-1, 5-1, 3-1, anything.
At 100%.
And rather than accept that or tell me to fuck off and reject it, he's like, okay, maybe one of the indictments ends up being something that he gets convicted for. He could have a health issue.
Yeah, yeah.
As they start talking, I'm like,
so
okay, hold
money,
on. You have all the information. You have it in here. It's there. And when you're forced to actually stake out a strong position, you do actually start to go through that logical thought process. But prior to that, nobody's holding you accountable for anything. That's true of even people in my position. Nobody holds content creators or alternative media people accountable for being wrong. There's a lot of reward for being hyperbolic, right? Nobody's going to listen to me if I'm like, I think Biden has a 52% chance of winning the election.
Yeah, yeah,
they want to hear Trump has no shot.
Like the Matt Walsh thing I'm thinking about, yeah.
Yeah. So I think there's just a lot of the stuff that pushes people into bad epistemic practices have nothing to do with philosophy or epistemology at all. It just has to do with, like, social cohesion and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's funny. If you were 100% on something, or at least I found, well, one, you'd give odds commensurate with that. Those being 100, and that means you're...
Big odds.
Like, that means that, like, there's no chance.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I'm 100% of, like, I mean, the earth existed before I was born, or this is a hand, they'll give you 100%. Okay, so a few things that I'm thinking of. I've been accused. I've been accused of Nazi, grifter, moron. I get those a lot. Those are the most common ones. You've been accused of a whole bunch of things, slander, slurs, etc. I wanted to take a look at this idea that you and I are grifters.
Okay.
My first question to you is, and then I'm going to ask you to interrogate me to see if I'm a grifter on something.
Okay.
So, what do you take the word grifter to mean? Let's start there.
Grifter is basically you don't have a genuine belief in the thing that you're professing to an audience, but you know that it's what the audience wants to hear, and you know there's a lot of money to be made there.
That's what I take it to be, too. Okay, so we're on the same page as that. So that's the other technique, like, define the words up front, everybody's mm-hmm. on the same page.
A lot of people use grifter as, like, a person's changed beliefs, or they just make money off their political beliefs, too, which I think is stupid, because I don't know, yeah. A lot of people use grifter in dumb ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think if someone changes their beliefs, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, you can change beliefs for good or bad reasons, but regardless,
yeah,
like, let's say, for instance, you have a certain set of beliefs, and then everybody here, you get into a really bad altercation, people bully the fuck out of you, and now you change your beliefs or whatever. That doesn't mean you're a grifter, just because you change your beliefs.
It could be a good thing. Mm-hmm. If nobody ever changed their beliefs, that would be, again, that idea of doxastic closure. You have a closed, sometimes it's a different way, epistemic closure. Okay.
Sure. So, which, funnily enough, some people consider a virtue. It's funny when you argue against religious people, they'll go, your science has changed, like, so many times, and my book has been the same for 1,500 years or 2,000 years. It's like, is that supposed to be an argument in your favor? It's like, but yeah, I understand some people. Yeah,
yeah, even in the language we use, like, flip-flop is a negative thing. As opposed to, well, you know, new evidence came in. Remember, I think it was I don't know, even like changing positions. You said you would commit this many troops in the ground when you ran. Yeah, but I didn't have, that was a time time t, and the time t1, I had new evidence, you know, of his bolo or whatever. Okay, so let's try to figure out if you and I are grifters.
Okay.
Okay. So I've read someone's accused you of, I don't want to talk about the Israeli Palestinian conflict, but people have accused you of grifting on about Israel.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? So is there a test that we can conduct to see if we're grifters?
If we define, okay, so if we define grifting as having a position only for the purpose of accruing the most amount of money.
That we don't believe. I think
that you don't genuinely have, yeah, you don't genuinely believe. I mean, there's several tests or ways you could go about it. One way could be historical. Where have your beliefs always been? Now, it's possible that they could change for a good or bad reason.
That's the problem with
so,
that.
So, yeah, that's one. All of this is going to be inductive, right? We can't 100% know. A second might be, what are your justifications for the belief that you have? And then can you apply that consistently across other things? So let's say for Israel-Palestine, you have the right to defend yourself when somebody attacks you, literally no matter what. It's like, okay, well, how do you feel about Ukraine-Russia? It's like, well, that's way different. It's like, okay, well, you need to have really good reasons now why you feel way differently. Which you might, by the way, that's not 100% either.
For sure, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Another way could be to, it's a bit shallower, but like, where's your bread buttered? Like, if you work for an organization that represents a certain political ideology, then that's always going to shade a lot of what you say.
Okay, so I'm going to throw something I've been thinking about that just happened to me. Excuse me, then I want to bring it back to this idea of grifting. So I was in a conversation with a guy who was Catholic. He just interviewed me and wherever the hell I just was. I don't even know.
Trent?
He's doing this documentary on this thing I did at Incubate Debate.
Okay, yeah.
And
sure.
He's a hard, you know, he's a pretty serious Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asking me about God, et cetera. And he said, wow, like, I thought you were going to debate me about that. And I'm like, no, I'm just trying to reason honestly with you about it. Like, I'm just trying to really, like, think through because I want to know what's true and I don't want to be incorrect in my beliefs. And so I'm thinking about that in terms of grifting because one problem that I know that I have is I'll see someone whose views I find just odious and utterly despicable. And the most charitable thing that you could say about these people is that they're mediocre intellects. And I'm going to name names.
Mm-hmm.
Ibram X. Kendi, Robin DiAngelo, these people have nothing of substance whatsoever. And so my natural inclination is to think, oh my God, these people are just total grifters. But I wonder, I think I'm doing that because I both find their beliefs to be reprehensible and they don't comport with my own. They're antithetical to my beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's easy to just like slam grifter. And I don't want to be in that position of thinking someone with whom I have a substantive disagreement, they're grifting and they don't actually believe it.
Yeah, I think there's like a whole classification of things. Is it Hanlon's razor where you like don't ascribe to malice but can be explained by stupidity?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of things where like if it comes to like grifting or if it comes to like malice, I need a lot to move me over there. Until then, I'm just going to assume it's all genuine because otherwise you get into a weird world of rather than dealing with what you're saying, I'm trying to deal with why I think you're saying it and I don't even,
Okay, so help me understand this then. So if you really want to, like I was thinking of a grifter test could be universally these people don't debate. Somebody offered Ibram X. Kendi $100,000 to debate me on this. Why would he do it? Because he can make more, and if he loses, his whole enterprise is utterly destroyed, right? So, but it would seem to me to be, and I don't even want to really necessarily debate, I would take a conversation, but it would seem to me to be a kind of test for grifting would be if you're willing to have a conversation, at the very least a conversation, if not a debate, about the ideas that you're espousing.
And if it could just be that you suck at debating, right?
Well, then you could do it on paper. You could do it via correspondence and then publish that.
I feel like the thing is that there's a lot more explanations I feel like I could conceive of before grifting that would explain why somebody would avoid that type of conversation. Maybe they think they can't defend their idea well. They'll look like an idiot.
Okay, correct me if my reasoning is there. So if you can't defend your idea well, then commensurate to the degree that you cannot defend your idea well, you would have to lower your confidence in the belief. You have to lower your you have to recalibrate that downward in terms of it being true.
Okay, that's interesting. You've introduced a second part to the grifting definition, which I think I can agree with. So let's say that you take a guy and let's say that he genuinely thinks that Donald Trump is innocent of all charges, okay? For the second condition you've applied to grifting is you would say that grifting can also be expressed as a form of how confident you are in a particular belief. So let's say you're like, I'm pretty sure Trump's not guilty.
Yeah.
I would say like 55%. I don't think he's guilty. But when you go to your audience, you say 99% Trump's not guilty. You would consider that the 44% difference, that's like the grift basically?
That would be, yeah, that would be a grift.
Okay.
And I keep coming back to this idea of how would you, because everybody is just capriciously hurling this at their ideological enemies. And it would seem absent a test, it wouldn't be, one ought not to use that word.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying. I think personally, I just would never use the word grift because there's so much baggage that comes up. But yeah. I would absolutely trash somebody if they're so confident of a position, but they won't debate publicly about it, or they won't even have a conversation about it, or they never have a challenging or critical or adversarial discussion about whatever that particular idea is, especially if they're a side that's talking about like freedom of speech and everybody should be talking to each other and debating and blah, blah, blah. I've never used the word grifter because like as soon as you use that, people's brains start to shut off like very quickly.
Yeah, and I will say that I've been disillusioned with many people in terms of they're not people who move in the public space, people who I know well, who won't publicly defend ideas against challenge. And I think what you said was very accurate. The larger the platform, the more one risks having a conversation with someone when they disagree because the consequences and the online social media mobs, you moron, you whatever the epithets that one would hurl. So
it sucks though because then it's almost like you're kind of misled as a viewer because like my assumption would be the people that are making it to the top, these are like you're forged in rhetorical fire. Like these are the people that have done the argumentation back and forth and they're the ones that have risen to the top on the backs of the best arguments when in reality they're just like, you know, trash college kids at a Change My Mind event or they did whatever and they didn't actually test any of these beliefs that much at all. And it's like, well, that's kind of interesting that these people have such high conviction and so many beliefs. You think they'd be able to just
100%.
Destroy it. Yeah. I had a big debate recently with an esteemed quasi-academic, I don't know, the Norm Finkelstein guy.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny because I'll reverse the roles in a lot of these. For this particular conversation, it was horrible. He was just like calling me names and screaming at me the whole time. And his argument afterwards, he just did a podcast with Brianna Joy Gray. Yeah. And he was saying, oh, well, I knew I was going to go in there and just shout at him the whole time because he didn't even deserve to be in this conversation and blah, blah, blah. And if I were to reverse the roles, and it's funny because I do all this on stream. I talk about like the rhetorical challenges of doing debates. That's like a dream scenario. Put me in front of somebody that I think is an idiot. It's just going to be me like making them look like an idiot the whole time. Not screaming at them and shouting at them. It's going to be me asking basic questions that they can't answer. It's going to be me giving like really good counter arguments that I know they haven't considered. And it's going to be me dismantling their entire worldview. If I'm in front of somebody and I start screaming, I know that at least in the audience's eyes, for anybody in the middle, I've already lost the battle. I can't do that.
What do you think they were attempting to achieve by that?
They just thought it was funny.
Wow.
Again, for a lot of people, I stress this so much on stream, there's this process of creating an applied position that almost nobody goes through. And you can immediately tell it based on the words that people say can be really important. It gives you a lot of insight into how they think. There was a part in this conversation where we argued about if two countries, I'm not trying to drift into Israel politics, I swear. We argued over this issue of like, do we think that this particular thing is apartheid? And one of my debate opponents brought up like, oh, well, I saw on your stream that you don't think Jim Crow was apartheid. And my understanding of apartheid in South Africa, which was like a top-down, very formal structure of segregation of multiple races into different areas where they're not even allowed to leave, is a lot different than Jim
Crow. It's literally systemic.
Yeah, but that's a lot different than Jim Crow, which was a lot of like individual local policies and stuff where it didn't actually make it illegal for black people to do some things, but they basically did because they were all wink-winking at each other. And in some cases, they kind of did. I think these are different. But then at the end, because I realize what's happening in his mind, apartheid means it's like an emotivist expression of boo, this is a bad thing.
Yeah.
Like it's non-cognitive, emotional, emotivist perspective.
Yeah.
When he says,
boo, hurrah.
What?
Boo,
yes.
Hurrah.
Yeah, yeah. When he says, so I asked him after that, I was like, hold on. Do you think that I support Jim Crow? And he said, I'm not sure. And I'm like, wait, what? Because I don't agree with the definition here. But that's because in their mind, this word, the apartheid thing, that's linked to the more, they're inexorably linked. So if you're disagreeing with this, you have to be disagreeing
100%.
With that. And then a second example, in this conversation, I brought up that like nuking a people might not even necessarily qualify as a genocide. That's what genocide is.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way that Brianna quotes my position on her show is, Stephen said it would be okay to nuke these people. I'm like, what? No?
So neither one of those are ways to reason honestly. So that tells me they're just so caught in an ideology, assuming that the report is accurate, that they're so caught in an ideology and that they're not concerned about truth. I think that there are certain ways to disarm that, but there is just so much bad faith going on.
Yeah. I try not to use bad faith because, again, that's in that bubble of, like, intentionality. I think a lot of people just get caught up
in ideology.
And, yeah, and a lot, and it's inconceivable to think of anything different.
Okay, so I think that's right. Maybe I'm going to walk back on the...
I mean, it kind of is bad faith. It's frustrating. But yeah, I'm very much over in the, like, I try really hard not to be super combative with any of my work. Like, there's a lot of things I'm fully bought into. I believe there's a lot of ways that men can express themselves in very toxic ways, but I'll never use the phrase toxic masculinity. Because as soon as I've done that, the brain is completely shut off, and now we're fighting over feminism. It's like, I don't even want to get into that. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
It's funny you mention that. So my buddy, Matt Thornton, wrote the book, The Gift of Violence, and I wrote the afterword to the book. And he was one of the first Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts. He's a very good friend of mine. Rob Wolf wrote the foreword to that book, the author. He's a brown belt in Jiu-Jitsu, just parenthetically. Anyway, so we got in this crazy conversation. I did an interview with this woman, Kara Dansky, who was... We did it in London. Anyway, and I asked her in this interview... How dangerous do you think society is for women on a scale from 1 to 10? She said nine.
Which society?
This one.
The U.S. one.
Yeah, okay. And I was just flabbergasted by it. I can't remember exactly what I said. Well, you know, like on a scale from 1 to 10, what's Saudi Arabia? What was the United States in the 1950s? Mm-hmm. And she told me a story about this trans woman, in other words, a man, who followed her into a bathroom.
Okay.
And she was really uncomfortable and she was upset. And she wrote a book about... dangerous to women, et cetera. And so I said to her, so what are you doing to protect yourself? And she said, well, I'm paraphrasing the conversation. I said, do you have mace? Do you have pepper spray? Do you do jiu-jitsu? Do you have a concealed carry? She didn't do any of these things. And I kept pressing her and saying, like, if you honestly believe that the threat is nine, if you, like, genuinely believe that, then wouldn't the appropriate, such a bullshit word, but wouldn't one take steps to mitigate those risks, right? So basically at the end, she said she was just lazy. Anyway, I'm mentioning this because my buddy who wrote this book, The Gift of Violence, starts talking about how important it is for women to learn self-defense. My daughter carries mace. My daughter's in jiu-jitsu. She does not have a concealed carry. She's not of that age yet. But the vituperation and fucking nastiness that he got from the radfems for suggesting that women learn how to defend themselves. So I'm only mentioning this because I'm walking back on the bad faith, because I think that's right. I think it's so ideological, they cannot fathom, and I've been thinking about this for days, ever since this Matt Thornton got in this Twitter thread. I've been thinking about it for days, like, they literally cannot imagine.
Yeah.
They literally cannot fathom why they would have to take any responsibility, and they view the whole thing as victim blaming.
And that's really funny because, like, that's such a good question. I think I've had conversations like that before where people say, like, I think that, like these people are stealing the election, or these people are trying to vaccinate us with horrible things, or these people are doing blah, blah, blah. It's like, we should grab rifles and go kill these people right now. It's like, what do you mean? We need to kill these people. They're literally doing this. We need to kill these people, right? Yeah. They're like, the Revolutionary War was started for less than what you're saying. And it's well, hold on. And it's like, yeah, because the actions don't match the intensity of the verbiage that you're giving. But it's almost like we're on this, we used to call it a euphemistic treadmill. Like, who wants to hear one word when the more extreme word is, like, so much more lucrative? And it, like, communicates so much more urgency and intensity. And it is totally possible that, for Israel-Palestine, that the Israeli government is doing horrendous things in the Gaza Strip that would qualify as war crimes, that would be completely and totally unethical, that are crimes against humanity. It's just horrible things to be happening, but it might not be genocide. That's inconceivable, though, to the people that would say there's a genocide happening. Because for you to say there's not a genocide happening is for you to say that everything they're doing is 100% A-OK. There's no middle ground. It feels like everybody has to use the most extreme version of whatever it is that you're talking about. Rape or sexual assault is also a really good one. There are no more bad sexual experiences. They're all rapes or assaults. There's no more asshole boyfriends. There's abusers or manipulators. There's no more he lied to me. It's he gaslit me. There's no more. Yeah, like, it's everything has just gotten so extreme. But it's like,
I do think there's a kind of, and I do think there's a kind of social media exacerbates and amplifies the virtue signaling behavior, mm-hmm. the virtue signaling verbal behavior. So you want to be seen as a virtue signaler. You want to be seen. And I saw that in that thread. Like, so I don't know, maybe, okay, so do you think that the ideological overriding, for lack of a better phrase, is so comprehensive and complete in these people that when they see an argument on the other side, for example, why women need to carry pepper spray, just as an example, that they cannot not, in other words, they have to characterize that in some kind of way to comport with their worldview. Like, is that bad faith? You know, like, is that, or is that you just so ideologically overridden that you can't think through issues?
The reason why I don't like to call it bad faith is because it does seem like bad faith implies some level of intent or knowing what you're doing. And when I deal, because I've talked to so many of these people, it really feels like the process is automatic. I used to call this the web, where as long as you're like tangentially in some kind of web of ideas, yeah. I can very easily go to the center. So if you tell me women should carry pepper spray, you think women should do it because you think that women are the reasons why they get raped. You think that men have no responsibility, and you're going to sit here and say that any woman that has gotten raped, if she didn't do anything to stop it, it's her fault. So like, I've got you like on this narrow thing, and it's like, I think this is rape apology, and I can like connect, and I was like, okay, you're a rape apologist. Easy. Everything you're saying is crazy.
I never even heard that phrase 2 years ago, and I just blew my mind. It like totally blew my mind that phrase even existed.
Which phrase?
Rape apology.
Oh, yeah.
Like, but yet there are spaces in India, for example, there are places in which there are, you know, I would name specific places in the Middle East, something in which they're actual rape apologists. But yet the same people screaming up the top of their lungs about rape apology don't even mention these places. I remember when I was teaching at a university in Portland, when ISIS was literally, they had a literal sex slave. They had a literal bazaar of women in which they sold them as cattle. Not a single word, nothing. No protests, not a peep, nothing. And I guess, again, going with the idea, I'm fascinated by this idea that it's not bad faith, it's just completely ideological overridden. Like, maybe their cognitions have been completely overridden by this, and they have to constantly signal to others. In this case, well, silence is violence, so they're committing violence. Violence is violence. That's the other thing. It's like, if you don't subscribe to the law of non-contradiction, life is so much easier for you. If you don't hold yourself to any standard of reason or rationality, then you can just kind of run roughshod for whatever you want.
A little bit, yeah. I think everybody, I mean, a priori, I think we all have non-contradiction, but we find ways to resolve it at least the way that I view it, if you've got dissonance in your mind, you resolve it in two ways. You either change your mind or you change the facts. And most people will just change the facts, basically.
Yeah, you write off something that comes in as anomalous or offensive.
Yeah.
All right, so would you be willing to grill me on whether or not I'm a grifter?
What are you most commonly accused of grifting on?
Well, I think that, so I get paid the Hungarian government pays me to go there. And just for the record, I get paid far more for one talk I give in this country. Just one talk, one time, and you can ask Erin, she's sitting right over there, she manages all my affairs, than I do for a month in Hungary. Mm-hmm. So I basically go around the country and speak about whatever I want. And I think people think I'm grifting because they look at my, I think no one will talk to me, so I don't know. But no one who disagrees with me will have a conversation with me. So I'm just making inferences from what I've read, that because I go to Hungary and take money from the Hungarian government for a month of work and a month of talks, that I'm somehow grifting and supporting the Orbán administration. So I'm hoping you can grill me about that.
I mean, the question would be, do you say things that are... What do you say about Hungary? Because it sounds to me like you're just getting money from somebody, but grifting implies a changing of positions or a disingenuous portrayal of your positions in order to have that money. So do you defend Hungary or do you defend...
No, I never talk about politics. I talk about...
Then I have no idea how that... What is the grifting?
How to have impossible conversations, to talk about my last book. I'm going to talk about my next book, about friendship, about how to be a good friend to someone. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand what the grifting accusation is then. It's confusing to me. Like, am I grifting for YouTube because I get paid money from AdSense? Like,
I guess is that you, because you're on YouTube, you support YouTube?
Oh, that's just like, I don't think that's necessarily grifting, but that's like, if you take money from an unethical source, does that make you an unethical person, basically, right? Like unethical consumption, basically?
Yeah, I don't think. Is anybody accusing me of that? I mean, people accuse me of stuff constantly. I don't. Are they accusing me of that? Okay, well, let's go for that claim. So have we killed the grifting claim then?
Well, for the hungry stuff, because you'd have to make a claim that somebody wouldn't believe, that you would actually believe in. So like, for instance, let's say somebody was, is Dennis Rodman, is he the guy that goes to North Korea all the time?
Yeah.
So when Dennis Rodman comes back, he usually says a lot of really positive things about what it's like to live in North Korea. So I think people would say that the grift there is because he's getting paid or has a relationship there. He's saying disingenuous things about North Korea. But if Dennis Rodman just went to North Korea all the time, but then came back and never spoke about it, I don't know what the grift is. He just goes over there and gets paid by them. The grift requires you to purport something that is not something you would actually genuinely believe, if not for the money or the audience capture or some other thing that was rewarding.
Yeah, and I never talk about it at all. Mm-hmm.
I think the thing for you, because I watched a fair bit of your stuff, the thing that I would wonder the most about...
Please, interrogate me.
So truth, I think, is... I think for most people, it's instrumental. Arguably for all people, that's a bit more complicated, but I would say for most people, it's instrumental. But it's also an aesthetic. And those two things mean that there's a lot of words that people use that are very frustrating that I don't even use to describe myself. So like if somebody's like, oh, like, well, how would you think of yourself? It's like, well, I try to be pretty rational and like pursue things that I think are truthful, even absent of like a political ideology, even if it goes, like that's something that every single person will say. But the reason why they say that isn't because they believe it, it's because truth as an aesthetic is actually really nice. Saying that you're nonpartisan is like, that's a nice aesthetic. It doesn't matter if it's true or not, it just feels and looks good to say it.
It's a good look.
Yeah. So the biggest worry for people that say things like you or like me is that for you, truth is simply like the aesthetic that you have, but given a certain challenging political question that would require you to break from your social groups, you would immediately abandon all of the rational, all of the logical, whatever, and you just fall into that and go like, oh, whatever, yeah.
So then in order to, correct me if I'm wrong, is the condition that I have to satisfy to show that truth is not merely an aesthetic is to show different positions I hold across different ideological frameworks.
That can be a way to show it, yeah. Doesn't necessarily make it true, but...
Let's do that. I mean, if that's the condition, or if you want me to satisfy another condition, tell me what that is.
Yeah, well, the issue is I don't know all of the different social groups that you run and everything. It was hard for me.
Yeah,
but I would say, if you were kind of a bog-standard centrist-y kind of person, then I would probably... It would be things related to, it would be foreign policy questions, because like Ukraine, Russia, or Israel-Palestine, these can be good testers of like, what's your rationalization for supporting one side or another? It would be things related to really controversial topics in the US, so things like COVID or the vaccine, you can really tease out like somebody's logical foundations there. It might be big policy related questions like climate change is a way to tease out. Because sometimes you can find people who are like, oh, like I'm an independent truth seeker or whatever, I just so happen to align 100% with every single anti-establishment person that exists out too.
It's interesting. The examples you gave are super interesting. So the older I get, I'm 57 now, the more I realize that maybe I'm becoming more Socratic as I get older. I don't know. Socratic in my disposition, not only my way of life. But I realize that there's just so much I don't know. And we live in a society in which people conflate platforms with knowledge. Like, oh, he has a big platform there, he must know. And I'm amazed at the shit people ask me all the time. Like, what's your opinion about this? Like, I have no... But the examples you gave were interesting. I've never talked about COVID because I have no expertise. I know nothing about medicine. Like, literally zero. I know zero about immunology. I know nothing about climate change because I know nothing about the physics of climate change or the... I'm fairly confident at this stage it's anthropogenic. Mm-hmm. What should be done about it? Tax on externalities. I have no idea what should be done about it. So I don't...
That's an acceptable answer. Then the next test, though, would be for consistency. So somebody might look at the United States, and let's say we're talking about the origins of COVID, right? Or the origins of SARS-CoV-2, okay? And I might say, okay, well, the majority of the intelligence agencies believe X, Y, Z. There's a little bit of dissent, but that's generally... And the person might go... I'm not going to believe everything the government says. I think for a good reason, there's a reason to be skeptical.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's a fair statement, assuming there are other ways. But then let's say that I, in a future conversation, because I wouldn't do it immediately after, because I don't know if I... Let's say in a future conversation, I notice that they are highly skeptical of trusting a lot of the U.S. institutions, a lot of the intelligence, which is fine, but they will uncritically and unwaveringly accept anything published by RT instantly. Russia Today publishes it, they believe it immediately. That's an incredibly odd... Double standard for evaluation.
Or they'll find an issue that happens to comport with their moral impulses, and they'll say, aha, and they'll, and you know, like the government says it's wrong about everything except it's wrong about everything. Just mm-hmm. as an aside, that's why I think it's so important to have ideological diversity within our academies, because when someone publishes a paper about warming being anthropogenic or what have you, they say, it's very easy for people on the right or even centrists to say, look, this is ideological, all these people are left-wing maniacs. But if you have in true intellectual diversity, it's like a Supreme Court of liberals and conservatives, and they have a 9-0 verdict. Mm-hmm. So
even, and even for what you said, the reality, in my opinion, is ideological diversity is really important for really the like the most like kind of pussy weak, like diversity makes us better. It really is, because what happens is when you're in an ideologically diverse environment, you see people with different ideas as people, as humans, and not like the fucking enemy. If you're in a room and all 10 people agree with you, whoever the fuck is in the other room, you don't care. They're in the other room, screw them. But if you're all together, well, fuck, you know, yeah, I deal with this guy every day. Like, he's not a horrible person. He has these beliefs. It's easier to humanize. And then you can deal with the beliefs themselves without immediately jumping to the worst assumption about that person's motives for having the belief.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to me how so many of these people only have their close associates who have total ideological congruity. Like, Reed's an atheist. I'm an atheist. I just met her today. I have no idea what she believes. But anyway, but we have people on the team who believe all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. And I have friends who have different beliefs. But back to this idea of grifting. So interrogate me about some of my beliefs. Literally anything you want. The truth as an aesthetic. It just interrogate me. Let's see if... Let's do it. I mean, or not. We don't have to do it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The only thing I heard you say earlier, trans woman, so a man. What are your general thoughts, I guess, on trans people?
That's great. So I think I get more shit about this by far. This mm-hmm. is, to borrow terms from statistics, this is the mode.
Yeah.
This is the mode of what I get shit about. I don't think, first of all, I don't really believe in the concept of transition, quote unquote. I don't think you can change your sex. But bracketing that for a second, mm-hmm. my position on trans is that children need to wait until their 18th birthday before they undergo medical procedures. And that includes hormone blockers, Lupron, et cetera. And on your 18th birthday, you can do anything you want. And that position has gotten me more grief. I've lost more personal friends, people I care about, people who have been in my home, people who have told me I'm on the wrong side of history. That one issue has caused me crazy grief. But wouldn't that be an example of going against my tribe? Wouldn't that be an example of not comporting with these, not having ideological congruity around one. Mm-hmm.
It could be. Well, no, so I'm curious on that particular thing. Do you feel like you have like a deontological, like principled attachment to that statement of being 18? Or do you think you have a more consequential view of waiting until you're 18? Let's say that it
Both.
Was the case. Okay, let's say that it was the case that, let's say that it was the case that you could identify hypothetically with 100% accuracy who was trans.
Like a brain test.
Yeah, like a brain test and a future mind reader, and God is there talking to you. He's like, oh yeah,
I'll satisfy just a brain test.
Sure, okay, yeah, brain test. Would you say that at like 13 or 14 they could start
yep,
like puberty
100%.
Blockers? Okay.
Yep, if we knew that there was something off in the brain, it couldn't be medically remediated, you couldn't have any kind of surgical intervention or cognitive neural.
Okay, hold on, I forget. So I would probably stop asking there. The fact, I don't know if you've run into people that say this, but the fact that you can even... I don't want to say admit that, like you've conceded it, but the fact that you even say that, I think, is already leaps and bounds ahead of where a lot of people would be. Because a lot of people would say, let's say I'm talking to a person who's like, yeah, well, I would always follow the medicine and the evidence. I'm like, okay, what if you made a brain scanner that could tell 100% of a person's trans?
Yeah.
Well, what if they changed their mind? Well, no. Say I could, like, it's 100%. It's like, well, we don't even have that technology. Yeah, but, like, let's say that we did. It's like, well, okay, but, like, would it even work? And it's like, when somebody can't even fathom, when
right.
they can't even understand the condition, like, what am I actually asking?
Right.
I'm just saying that if you could know 100%, it doesn't matter if it's a fucking brain machine or not, right. okay? That's not important. I'm saying if you knew this 100%, what would your decision be? The fact that they can't even like tangle with the hypothetical is like,
yeah.
makes me wonder, it's like, okay, yeah. Because I would say my current position is
yeah.
that I think that under 18, I think you should have access to puberty blockers.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I do, yeah. But that's like a pretty low conviction belief because there's a lot of competing evidence that comes out. And if it was the case that you find out that like, you know, 80, 90% of these kids that start it, or even maybe like, probably even like 10 to 20, 30% that started. If that was the case that they regretted it, it's probably too high of a cost to pay for the...
It's like a falsifiable defeasibility condition. Like that's the condition under which you would change your mind.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, medicine, all medicine is bad for you. The goal is just that whatever it does good is better than the bad. That's how medicine works, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's nothing is 100%. Nothing only has positive. Even if you take too much, was it Advil, it can thin your blood too much, you die or whatever. Or maybe I'm thinking of ibuprofen. But like, yeah, everything at the end of the day is like trade-offs. But it would be like, well, I just need to understand the trade-offs, and if it's worth it in terms of how many people are helped versus how many people are hurt, I'd be in
so
favor of
it. So a consequentialist view.
Essentially, yeah.
My buddy Tim Urban told me that my position on this is a fairly mainstream liberal thing, or it used to be 20 years ago about the transitioning thing. So is there anything else you can help me think about I don't know if you could help me figure out if I'm disingenuous, only because you don't know my intent. But I guess, like, could you figure out, maybe you could tease out an inconsistency in some things I believe, or see if I'm grifting, or we don't even have to talk about my beliefs, we can talk about your beliefs.
I mean, I think there's a lot of, like I said, you've had a lot of conversations with people. I'm sure for you there are red flags that pop up immediately just in the way that somebody talks. So, and I just pointed out that for you, the fact that you were willing to say immediately, oh yeah, if you can know with the brain scan 100%, I'd be okay with this. I think that that's like an indicator of like, okay, well, I think your mind is aimed in the correct direction for sure. Like, yeah. It seems like there's a better thought process there than like, I can't even conceive of a hypothetical where I might be wrong, you know?
Yeah, so do you have a belief in which you've extended the confidence in that belief beyond the warrant of the evidence?
Probably.
What do you think those are?
Well, if I knew, I wouldn't.
Yeah, you wouldn't. Yeah.
I mean, there are times where there's a few things that I try to ask myself. One is, do I feel like I can argue both sides of a thing? That's incredibly important.
Can I pause you on
yeah.
that for a second? So I've been thinking about this a lot. What do you think about this idea that if you don't know the other side of a position, then you ought to recalibrate your confidence in what you believe and decrease it?
A little bit. I would make a more extreme statement. If you don't know the other side, you don't even know your side. You can't possibly know one side.
That has a pedigree in the literature. Okay, I would say that was the first thing. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, yeah, but I would say, yeah, you should be able to argue. For any debate that you see me have, I should be able to argue both sides better than the person that I'm debating every single time. Because if you can't, then they're going to give you an argument that you're not ready for, and how are you going to...
Yeah, I'll push back in the other direction with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually incumbent upon you to do so, to make better arguments than the people with whom you have substantive disagreements if they can't make them. And I've tried to do that with like the Steele Manning and the woke stuff, and we try to do that with the spectrum street epistemology. But because you're right, because when you said to me before, maybe someone isn't a good debater, like, but maybe someone has the truth. Like maybe someone knows what's true, but they just don't have the cognitive wherewithal to articulate it, or it's this vertiginous array of trying to look at the issue and they have vertigo and they're trying to like freak out. So I think it's incumbent upon us to make those arguments better than the other people. But I will say the thing that injects static in the system that makes it difficult to do is when everybody's calling you a Nazi and a grifter and a moron.
For sure.
And the other thing that makes it difficult is when you have a belief. The thing I think that's lost in what you said is that you can't find people, interlocutors, who will engage you, so then you can never really test your own beliefs, which has always been a problem for me.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I interrupted again.
No,
so
yeah, you're good. I agree. Yeah. That doing argumentation is like, just because you know something, you can't teach it. Right? There's going to be somebody that knows a lot about a particular thing, but that doesn't mean they can teach it. And just because you understand a topic well also doesn't necessarily mean you can argue it. There can be, I think argumentation is a whole skill in and of itself, such that like, and I try not to do this anymore, but I used to fall into this, like, and I'm sure you've had these moments, you can be in an argument where you don't actually know the facts. You realize like, fuck, this got ahead of me and I don't know what I'm going. But yeah. I know enough like capital logic that I can poke and prod and figure out inconsistencies and like try to win the argument because you're not fully consistent in what you believe, and then be okay that way. But you're not really doing this from like a factual, knowledgeable foundation. You're doing it like on the philosophy, like argumentation side, the prop logic side, like, okay, I got you there, motherfucker. Like, yeah, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's like an exercise in like if you're very good at just arguing and knowing how to respond to a thing and knowing what logically refutes a thing and knowing what qualifies for evidence and what doesn't qualify for evidence. That in and of itself is a whole skill set to learn. Yeah,
I completely agree. In the Gorgias, Socrates says that being refuted is the greater gain of the two. You know, to refute or be refuted, it's better to be refuted than it is to refute. And the idea inherent...
Only if you're seeking truth, but yeah.
Yeah, that's the idea inherent in that is that you can look at it one of two ways. You can become closer to the truth or you can shed falsity. Like, if you look at this whole thing as a massive epistemic system in which we want to have more true beliefs and fewer false beliefs, You ever see the show, you're kind of younger than I am, but you remember the Highlander, people who ran around and chopped each other's heads off with the swords? Yeah. So, like, if you were living for thousands of years until someone chopped your head off with a sword, maybe the best way to think about one's epistemic situation or your epistemic situation is to figure out how to have more true beliefs. But given that we're extremely limited, it's just way more efficient to figure out what's false and stop believing it.
Yeah, it just depends on what your goal is at the end of the day. I used to be a professional StarCraft II player. I don't know if you ever heard of the game.
What's the game?
StarCraft.
Of course. I used to play StarCraft.
Okay.
Yeah, I love StarCraft.
I was a pro StarCraft II player.
What race did you play?
Zerg.
Oh, I like the Protoss. I can see you as a Zerg, totally.
Okay. Well, all the epistemic trust and everything I had in you just completely fucking disappeared. Because Protoss is literally like the 25 IQ, bad faith, race for dipshits. But
really?
I'll let you slide on that.
I don't see that at all. But
of
anyway,
course
go
you
ahead.
Don't, because you're lost in your own echo chamber of But for StarCraft, if I were to ladder for a day, if I were to play 30 games and I were to win every single game, my mechanics are getting a little bit better, but I'm not like changing anything. Like my builds are good.
Totally.
Right? But if I play, if I lose like 7 games in a row to Protoss, okay, well, I need to go back and dramatically adjust my build. Something's not working. This particular rush is, this immortal timing is always crushing me and I need to change my build. And the next day, the best thing is when you lose a lot in a day, you go
100%.
Back, you iterate your build, and then you come back with a better build and then you win against it. It's like, this is better. Now in laddering, that's really good. But if I'm in a tournament, I don't want to fucking learn.
Okay.
If I'm in the finals of a tournament,
totally.
If I'm debating Steven Crowder, if I'm doing this, well now, fuck epistemic humility and everything. I'm not here to learn and practice. I need to win now, right?
Right.
So the motives and the rewards and the incentives are very different in the tourney setting, or maybe like in the YouTube or online content creator setting, versus like the I'm laddering and practicing or in a classroom. And I think that's the incentives are important to keep
in mind. Okay, so now I want to relate that to instrumental rationality.
Mm-hmm.
So I am trying to get my black belt in jiu-jitsu.
Mm-hmm.
And so last night I was in a Boca Raton and I was wrestling a call roll and I was rolling with these guys and I would much rather lose every roll than win because that way, so I was rolling with this guy and he just kept getting me in leg entanglements, which is, and heel hooks are very nasty. They're like the worst thing in jiu-jitsu. Like you do not want to get caught in a heel hook. But anyway, this guy kept heel hooking me. And it really taught me, again, the importance of I got to keep my legs in certain positions. Like, but what would I have gotten if I just went in the gym and tapped out blue belts and purple belts? Like, yeah. And then I had this fucking monster of a guy who was a black belt on top of me. And it was just utter agony. This guy was just killing me. But that was an opportunity to learn, right? So I think that there's a kind of disposition that if you want to get better at something, you have to constantly undergo the process of failing, of losing, of submitting, of tapping. And I think that that itself is a disposition. And some people do not possess that disposition. Some people are not willing to go through what it takes in order to achieve a state of excellence. And you have to fail. Like that was the Steve Jobs things. To succeed, you have to double your failure rate.
That is true. Or what's the quote? Like the master has failed more times than the novice has even attempted.
Right.
That is true, but it's just it's incredibly challenging to balance that with I am a YouTuber and people look up to me ostensibly because I'm correct about a lot of things. And that's part of my character and that's part of who I am. That's part of what I'm known for. So for me to throw myself into an arena where it's like, oh, I could be totally fucking wrong about this, that sort of epistemic humility is not rewarded on the content creator front or on the media front, right? Yeah, so those are very competing very competing incentives, yeah.
Okay, so let me throw this out to you. So you said you're a YouTuber, people look up to you because you're correct. Wouldn't the ideal situation of a kind of society we want to create would be people looked up to you, for example, if you debated someone and said, wow, you know what, I debated this guy, I went in, it's the Plato's Gorgias again. I went in there with thinking this, I debated this guy, he changed my mind, I no longer believe this. Like, wouldn't that be the thing to what, like, the virtue to which you should aspire and to the thing to which everyone else should say, wow, destiny, Steven, do change his mind. That's my man.
It would be cool. I'm going to be that guy. Have you ever watched The Wire?
I love The Wire.
Okay. What do you think was the number one biggest problem with the kids in school? Like the kids in the school that sucked at school and didn't pay attention. What is like the biggest problem? It's true in the real world too.
Organizational barriers in the home life.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with school, right? It's everything that happens before school.
Yeah.
I agree with you. How cool of a society would it be for people to treasure people that change their minds or they have epistemic humility or whatever. But the reality is that's a process that starts like at birth. Like you have to train people very specifically to value that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's funny. I talk a lot about like rhetoric with my audience. Like, well, when I go into this debate, what am I trying to do? What's my goal? Yeah. How am I going to navigate? Because the rhetoric is just as important as the fact and logic. And I have to be one challenge that I have is I hedge a lot because people clip me on every, one or two things I've said here that will get clipped because people will clip you. So I try to hedge a lot of what I say.
Yeah.
But if I'm arguing against somebody who has no humility and no shame, and they say something like, do you think that Russia is actually going to lose the war in Ukraine? And I'm like, I mean, it's possible that if they get enough arms, F-16s, they come. It's like, and they're like, there's no chance. There's no shot that they lose. And I'm like, it's possible. I look weak there. Just rhetorically, like, okay, well, this guy here, this guy is like fucking on it. He knows his shit. He's like giving 100% statements. And this other guy is like kind of a pussy. He's like, clarifying or he's like, he's hedging everything. He's like caveating. And it's like, ugh, fuck that, you know? I think that there is an attraction to or draw to people that can make very strong, concrete statements with a high level of conviction.
I completely agree.
Which is really frustrating.
No, I completely agree. To me, everything you just said was an argument against debate and for conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it's semantic distinction. At the end of the day, well, ideally, every debate should be like a good discussion, right?
Yeah, like truth-seeking if your idea is to grow your platform and smite your ideological enemies and, I do think that lends itself to the danger of ideological capture.
For sure.
Yeah.
Then keep in mind, the incentives are so much at play. To some extent, you really are trying to smite your enemies because at the end of the day for politics, you go to the ballot box and you only vote for one party. So it is important at the end of the day, well, who's right? Is it the guy with the D or the guy with the R or is it an independent guy? So then when I listen to my political speakers, one of you guys has to be correct. It's not enough for you to be truth. I need to know who's right here. So there's a lot of competing things at play that are making people sometimes have to stake out stronger positions than they maybe should be able to. But,
and that would be a good argument against kind of not belief revision or open-mindedness, but you know, like we have a problem, and maybe we can talk about this. I don't know. I am utterly amazed by what's happening on the southern border. I'm amazed by many things in this country. Mm-hmm. The printing of money is completely insane to me, completely fucking crazy. This not securing the southern border, maniacs, pedophiles, rapists. You don't remember this, but when I was a kid, Castro emptied the mental asylums and the prisons, and he sent everybody. Actually, we're in Miami. Aren't we in Miami? Yeah, he sent everybody.
My mom is Cuban. I grew up. I went to Hialeah a lot.
You're probably familiar with that. So, but that would be an argument against. So, I do understand. Like, you want debate, you want conflict, you want like because we do have these existent problems that we need to solve, and people do like their strong voices. The problem is, my concern is that people will listen to the loudest voice, like you said. Maybe they're good at rhetoric, but maybe they haven't really thought through their beliefs, thought through the other side of these, or they just have an apologia. You know, they have this idea that here's the other side of the issue. Let's refute that and truth be damned.
Mm-hmm. Conflict breeds positive things only if the conflict itself is productive. If you're going after a black belt in jiu-jitsu, maybe somebody's told you this, maybe they're not, but like, a thing that you learn in grade school is like practice makes perfect. And then as soon as you reach like any type of like college level or professional level or whatever, you immediately unlearn that. Practice does not make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. If you don't practice correctly, you're totally fucking wasting your time.
That's such a good point. Yeah. Let's talk about that for a second. Let's linger on that. Because I'm sorry to keep talking about jiu-jitsu. I'm sorry. But
you're good.
But my coach, Matt Thornton, says you should be drilling 90% of the time and rolling 10% of the time. And the reason for that is exactly what you just said. If you just keep wrestling all the time, not only will you repeat the same mistakes, but you'll cement those mistakes. And then it'll make it even more difficult. So you need to drill, you need to practice, but not necessarily in that, not only 10% of the time. And I think people do that in cognitive domains and other arenas of their lives too. They just kind of repeat these mistakes. And not only that, they kind of talk themselves out of even that qualifier, kind of makes the statement less strong, but more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of talk themselves out of ways of reasoning and thinking that are epistemically justified, but not morally acceptable.
Yeah. People have way too black and white a view of everything. And when they think about a certain thing, they think it's either all good or all bad. One thing that people don't realize is bad habits are incredibly effective in some ways. Maladaptive behavior is incredibly effective in some ways. There's a reason why it exists.
That's people the instrumentalism for that you talked about before.
Yeah, for jujitsu or for StarCraft, because programmers would give lessons to students, so we give lessons to students, and it always sucked because like a guy would come to you and be like, I want to do this huge build. They've got a build planned out to like 100 supply. I want to do this and this and that and that and that. I'm like, okay. Well, what league are you in? They're like, I'm in silver. And I'm like, okay, well, this game, we're going to do one base, one building, and I just want to see if you can build these things in time. Because all this other shit you want to do, none of this fucking matters if you can't just do this.
Yeah, exactly.
And the problem is that when That's people learn true. Things like bad habits as opposed to like fundamentals, a bad habit, if you've got a player that is learning or somebody in jiu-jitsu or anything, whatever road you can take to get good at something, if you do bad habits, you will get better faster. Every time. That's why it's a bad habit, because it's a shortcut. But the problem is once you get better, you will plateau before the good practicer. And if you want to get better, you can't start doing the good habit. You have to unlearn. And that process of unlearning is where 99% of people will get stuck and quit or never leave the bad habit, because I'm not going to get fucking worse at something for a while. I got to go back to this bullshit and then try. It's the temptation to fall back into. It's like a wood board where you're carving it with a knife over and over again, and you want to carve a slightly different path. It's always going to fall into the same groove because it's so easy.
I feel like I'm talking to myself. I truly feel like I'm. So that's the thing. It's like Matt will say, you'll if you do all this stuff, you'll be a really good blue belt or a really good purple belt, but you'll never advance beyond that. Mm-hmm. That's why I think it's so interesting. This is the last jiu-jitsu reference. That's why I think it's so interesting, Reed's over there dying, that what you said about better fundamentals. Like the best guys have white belt techniques at black belt levels. Like when Roger Gracie came out of retirement and beat this other guy, he didn't beat him through a flying armbar. He beat him through a rear naked choke. Like having those solid fundamentals. And I think
I don't think he was a good fighter, but I don't know. But like with the Bruce Lee of like, I fear the man who's practiced one kick 10,000 times,
yes,
not the man who's practiced 10,000 kicks one time. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. And I think intellectually we get more mileage from cleaning up our thinking at a rudimentary level as opposed to trying to figure out kind of quote unquote advanced thinking techniques. No, there's like basic techniques at black belt level. You know, I've been, which kind of reminds me, I've been thinking about this thing for a long time now. I've been wondering if there's like a unified field theory of rationality, you know, something that just brings together disparate elements of rationality in one large explanatory model of, and I'm just throwing that, I'm just kind of riffing,
yeah,
thinking out
saying.
Loud here.
The unfortunate feeling I have is that like, I don't think like anybody can learn propositional logic. I don't think rationality logic, I don't think any of that is actually that hard or challenging. I think all of the challenging stuff falls squarely under the domain of like psychology. I think that all of the epistemic flaws, all of the, because it's not like we don't have.
You think they're dispositions?
Yeah. It's not,
I do too.
Yeah.
100%.
Like any human being can like see a syllogism, right? Yeah. If I ask a person, okay, all men are mortal is premise one. Premise two is Socrates is a man. What's the conclusion?
Yeah.
They'll be able to say, oh, Socrates is immortal, is a mortal, right? Yeah, oh yeah. If I say, okay, let's try this syllogism. Okay, so just premise, conclusion. So let's try this one, okay? All vaccines work, okay? The COVID vaccine, the mRNA vaccine is a vaccine.
Yeah.
Therefore, okay, well, hold on. I'm like, well, no, I'm not asking you to evaluate for soundness. I just want to see if you can follow
validity.
The logic.
So,
but the thing is what you said. It's like, it's that's not a problem of rationality. It's not a problem of I can't compute a syllogism. It's all the other dispositional
it's
stuff
a disposition,
that
yeah.
fucks people's minds up, I think, yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. So the thing that I've been thinking about when I taught in the prisons, this really drilled this home to me, like, how do you help someone develop a disposition to bring them closer to reality? I think that the answer, the older I get, the more convinced I am that the answer is you have to link the disposition to morality. Like, good people, if you want to be a good person, they have these dispositions. Like, they're epistemically humble, or they revise their beliefs when faced with competing evidence, or they trust full of reason, they formulate their beliefs in the basis of evidence, whatever it is. But absent that moral component, we're complex creatures, and the water is very muddy already, and we're trying to live our lives in instrumental rational. We're just trying to use our reason to get us certain things and to, you know, make sure we have a place to stay and enough money to eat. When those dispositional aspects are linked to some kind of moral foundation, people are more likely to adapt the behaviors that lead to their own flourishing and the flourishing of their societies.
Yeah, I think the way that I view it is I come at it from a different way. I think it just comes down to where the rewards are. I look at the incentive structure and the rewards because I feel like there really isn't much reward for having a good, reasonable thought process about things. And there's a lot of reward for social conformity. So if I look at one area where there is so much reward for just like believing, buying into whatever constellation of ideas this group of people has, and then if you engage in more critical thought, well, now I'm asking questions about, you know, like, do I really think that all white people are oppressors in the United States and now my whole fucking friend groups hates me. Right. I don't think the average person is going to go down that road of like, I am going to have some serious questions about like, you know, is BIPOC a good way to organize people in society, or is DEI or affirmative action the best way to...
Yeah.
And if you start asking those questions, okay, well, what's the reward? I mean, you've got, you know, in your room, you can jerk off to how rational and you're at least committing down a better road epistemically. But then in the real world, okay, well, now my friends don't talk to me as much. I'm in a really awkward place in work because I got into an argument with a coworker over this. And now my family doesn't like me as much, or we can't talk about this at dinner. Well, damn, if that's what your life looks like, holy shit. It doesn't surprise me that the average person is more like, well, fuck. Ideological conformity exists for a reason, and my tribe accepts me more when I do it, so fuck all this other bullshit. Yeah,
it's interesting. During the height of the BLM thing, Douglas Murray was staying with me, and my daughter put... one of my neighbors came up to me when I lived in Portland and said to her something like, you know, why don't you have a BLM sign? So he put a BLM sign, and Douglas Murray said, why do you guys have a BLM sign? You think it's bullshit. Right? So there's kind of like a conformity, like even within my neighborhood, even within that, like, I don't know. It's like, I want to maintain good relations with my neighbors. I don't want my physical neighbors in particular, like the people who live next to me. I also want to live I want to have my integrity. My daughter put up the sign. I didn't tell her to take it down or whatever. I don't think it was a prophylactic against some maniac from, you know, destroying the house or firebombing. Nothing happened, fortunately. But, you know, I wonder about that. Like, I wonder the degree to which, I think the word conformity is too strong, but I wonder the degree...
Yes. Conformity is, you say it's strong, but it's because it's so normatively loaded. But it's not really that bad. If you really think about it, same thing with like virtue signaling. Like, it's important. I want people to know what I think about some things. Like, if somebody's saying or doing something, if I'm a really patriotic person, you know, I might put my hand over the pledge because I want people to know that I'm patriotic. I do feel strongly about this. Or if I have, so virtue signaling or signaling virtues isn't necessarily bad. It's only bad if you're doing it disingenuously or performatively. You don't actually believe it.
And like kneeling, like kneeling in football.
Potentially,
games.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, or conformity is only bad if you're like forced to against your will, but to some extent, like, yeah, we want to conform around certain like social values and certain norms and certain ways of believing and behaving. And yeah, but it's hard to identify like when is that a good thing or when does it become toxic or how much room is there for exploration, which I think is the important part. But again, I think a lot of that comes from the problem is that when we talk about conformity and all these things for the social groups, the moral value and the apply position are so inexorably linked that you would hope, like the goal, the dream would be there's a high, really rigid level of conformity around these fundamental beliefs. But when it comes to the applied positions, there's a lot more room to explore. So all of us will be together and we all agree on some very moral level. Every human being deserves to have a roof over their heads. Nobody should be homeless. That's insane. But you might think that the way to do that is through rent control. I might think the way to do that is to empower entrepreneurs to hire, you know, homeless people to work with whatever. And we can disagree on that. We can even disagree adamantly and fight a lot. But I'm never going to accuse you of wanting people to be homeless. And you're never going to accuse me of hating homeless people. That's never going
to
be the case.
And within that context, the way to figure out what would be true about that, unless somebody knows, I mean, I'm not even going to take out the qualifier. The way to figure that out would be through discourse and dialogue.
Yeah, and empirical tests running it, yeah.
Yeah, you'd have, right. Well, that would be part of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's interesting to me how we've shifted from the role evidence plays in one's belief or should play and, you know, the importance of, again, I'm not a big fan of debates, but if you want to debate about it, great. Schellenberger's done some wonderful work on that. San Francisco, okay, great. And I know Mark Benioff from you know, the Salesforce CEO disagrees. And okay, but the homelessness is interesting. I think we've lost that, and instead we've gone to,
you're a rapist, right? We've gone through, I'm specifically talking about where we've lost it.
I don't know. I'm not sure how.
Like college campuses. Mm-hmm. Like I'm thinking about, you know, somebody goes in and gives a talk. We have groups of kids who blow in bullhorns instead of having an alternative speaker come in.
But think about it. Think about it. Like way back in the day, what's the reward for being like that on a college campus? I don't know, some social group. What's the reward today? Bro, I can stick a phone in your face and you become famous overnight.
Like
how do you know who Greta Thunberg,
Jordan Peterson, Brett Weinstein.
Sure, or Greta Thunberg or any of these students or whatever. Yeah, like I can have the entire fucking world watching my protest when I'm 18, 19, 20. Holy shit. Bro, if I would have been a streamer, I have burned shit that I wrote when I was 16, 17, because I was such a fucking crazy high school full of myself. Because when you're 16, 17, you know the answer to everything, right?
Yeah.
If I would have become super famous or popular at that age, I can't imagine how much of an arrogant, snobby piece of shit I would be as a human being.
Yeah, and you'd be less likely to revise your beliefs.
Yeah.
Because you had an audience. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you wouldn't be. And then also, and the college thing comes up so much, and the thing that bothers me so much about it is that, like, people will say things like college students are radical or extremists, whatever. And it's like, yeah, they should be. You should be fucking. I loved Ron Paul and Ayn Rand when I was a college student. Yeah. But that's, you're 18, 19, 20. You've just got out of home. You're in college. You should be fucking insane and crazy at that age.
Yeah.
That's fine. But you should be insane and crazy. But you should also have room to explore it. And then hopefully the ability to kind of grow out of it as well. Like that's part of that journey. But as soon as you start sticking a phone in people's faces, you are cementing and solidifying beliefs that are still very much congealing in a person's mind, and it makes it so hard and scary to connect the crazy, radical, insane things that college kids do. When you start connecting that and immortalizing it in the real world and then giving them voices and saying that, like, your voice, like, no offense, I don't give a fuck what an 18-year-old thinks about employment or minimum wage. Like, bro, you haven't even worked a fucking job before. Why the fuck would I care what you would have to say about any of this, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, their opinions are just as important as everybody else's, because on Twitter, we all have one account. You know, you've all got the same letter of characters you can put in your tweets and everything. Yeah, I just think that it's the incentive structure, the rewards. Like, what are you rewarded for? And then as soon as you think about it in that way, I feel like the behaviors of everybody become very, very, very obvious. Like, I would expect kids to be attention-seeking at 18 when they're crazy and they want to do all this shit. Like, that's just always going to happen.
Yeah, and that is magnified, and it's made significantly worse in academia because you have the same mechanism that you just articulated is applied to the peer review process and promotion and tenure. You have people publishing articles that are morally fashionable, that align with the orthodoxy, that are completely untethered to reality. Frankly, they're fucking deranged. And they are reward because of university architecture and incentivization structures. They then get promotion and tenure. They then teach those articles. They then indoctrinate people. Massive problem. So in that sense, I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about, I haven't read Haidt's new book, but he talks about the social media and how that process, which we haven't talked about, makes kids anxious, particularly young kids, and the consequences that it's had on our society for people. And I find that to be, we've just rushed headlong into this and we haven't really thought through it.
Incredibly aggravating, yeah, because you've got, like, in my mind, you've got, like, feminism and, like, the woke and the Trumples and the red pill. You've got, like, all these things. And then you've got, like, the internet. And when people talk about what's changed in society, it's this fixation on whatever your personal little pet project is, like, oh, that's crazy. You're a feminist and you think that toxic masculinity explains every single social ill? What are the chances of that, right? Or, oh, you know, you're a hardcore conservative and you think the loss of religion and Christianity in the West is the reason why every single bad thing is happening in the world? That's crazy how that works out. But like the change in our lives has been like unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah, people
in a really short amount of time too. Holy shit!
Yeah, that unicausal, that univariate. Like people look for one causal explanation, one univocal. Oh, you know, we all speak with one voice. We know that this is the problem. And I often wonder, like, how do you design? Okay, so here's something I've been thinking about. I wonder if. So I've been reviewing for my book on friendship, my next book that I'm writing, I've been reviewing the literature throughout the ages of like what makes a good friend from antiquity and beyond. And then in the process of this, I've been thinking about various kinds of cultural myopia and social beliefs that have gripped society throughout the ages. And I think it's McIntyre who writes, every age has a dominant moral value. Like in Homer's time, it's strength. Voltaire's time, it's humor. Aristotle's time, I'm going out of non-chronologically, but it's, you know, the Athenian gentleman, and now we have, you know, intersectionality or whatever. And I'm wondering if, and I'm just tossing this, I'm kind of thinking a lot, I wonder if there's a kind of meta-prophylactic, like something we can do with our institutions, or I don't know if it's we codify it in a kind of Ten Commandments, like I don't know what it would look like, but some way that we could have to prevent society from being held hostage to whatever is morally fashionable. Like, is there something we can create? Is there something we can, something, again, I have no idea what it would look like, to prevent us from falling into ideology and dogma?
I would turn the question on its head a little bit, and I would say that we'd probably agree, how to do that is actually probably incredibly easy. The challenging part is getting everybody to recognize that there's a problem.
So how would you do that?
I have no idea. Oh, okay. If I knew that, I wouldn't be talking. You gotta be a billionaire reshaping societies in other parts of
all,
the planet.
All society, right.
But the problem is just, it's the incentive structure. There's so much reward for, I challenge people a lot on this. When people, especially when it comes to relationships, people will say things like, this person is so irrational. I can't believe they're doing this or that. Or like, my child is so irrational, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, every human mind, absent psychosis or a lot of drugs, every human mind, a priori, is granted with perfect rationality. We all understand causality. Everybody understands this. Your kid right now is not being irrational. The reason why he's screaming and doing this is because he knows if he does it long enough, you're going to give him what he wants. That's perfectly rational behavior. Or this person that is abusive or manipulative or does this, they're not being irrational. They're doing exactly what they're doing to get exactly what it is. It might even be...
Behaviorist.
Everything is pretty rational. So when you look at like the structure of society and why people use the logic shortcuts or illogical behavior, whatever they do, it's because it's usually always, it's always serving some other greater purpose. And the goal would be somehow to disconnect that. Like, how do you reward people for exercising extreme epistemic humility versus people that don't? How do you have, you've got three guys in the jungle 20,000 years ago, and two of them see a bush shaking, and they're like, I know that's a lion, I'm going to leave. And the third guy's like, I'm actually going to go investigate. And it's a lion, he gets fucking eaten. Yeah. How do you make a society that rewards the third guy, not the other two?
Yeah, especially in that case, Shermer talks about that, type one and type two, or it's from Kahneman, that... You know, how do you you have evolution behind it. I was thinking what you said about extreme epistemic humility, and I was thinking about just the value of kindness. Like, how do we instill value of kindness? And then I was thinking to myself, well, what if kindness, for example, and extreme epistemic humility are values that we should not be putting in, and we're spending all of our time thinking about how to put these values in? You know, like, again, there must be some kind of way, or maybe there isn't, or maybe we need AGI or something to figure this out, but how do we figure out the values we're embedding in our institutions or the values that we should be embedding in our institutions and those values that govern the society? I think I know what those are, but again, I have to be open to revision to what those are. But the moment you open it to revision, then you can't say that that's the bedrock upon which you should ground society because they're open to revision.
Yeah, because we all kind of fall into a little bit of epistemic circularity if we get to the very bottom of anything we believe at the end of the day. I thought about this a lot when I was like 16, 17, 18. I grew up very Catholic. I went to Catholic schools, and then I kind of became atheist through high school. And one of the biggest issues I had coming out of high school and going to college is I kind of thought, you know, like, okay, well, atheist, truth-seeking, like, let's say that I'm, like, the most correct guy in the world, I know everything. Like, let's say you follow a dude's life to the end of his lifespan, and, you know, he's a hardcore atheist, and he's unlocked the secrets of the universe, and he knows that once he dies, it's all over, and blah, blah, blah. And then you take some, you know, 90 IQ farmer guy who's, like, super religious, but he, like, loves his family, grows up and he sees his kids, he takes care of the farm animals, pretty simple life, and then they both die. Like, at the end of the day, like, who's better off for it? And I feel like that's a hard one to grapple with sometimes, that, like, the hardest thing for a lot of people to understand is there can be people that do horrible things, think stupid things, just are wrong in so many different ways, and they could go through all of life being blissfully happy and die without knowing it at all. And yeah, so it becomes hard at the end of the day to say, well, what values even should we be injecting into society? I'm not even 100% sure of that. It's challenging. But I think it's pretty obvious that where we're at right now is not good because there's a lot of immediate short-term issues we're having with the totally different realities that different people are living in the United States in ways that aren't working, but yeah.
Which terrifies me. Before we go down that rabbit hole, I was thinking, like, boy, is there anything like we could truly agree upon that we should do in society? And again, I don't know. I mean, it would seem to me that you want to create a society in which someone wants to be religious, they should be religious, like they have cognitive liberty. Great piece, by the way, on NPR, on the Free Press about NPR's ideological capture. But so then I was thinking, like, well, what about just a tax on, people used to call it a Twinkie tax, a tax on sugars, right? A TAX tax, not a tax.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, could we agree that obesity is a bad thing and that we have to kind of, mitigate those risks for obesity and diabetes, et cetera, by having this top-down governmental structure in which we kind of have a social engineering platform? And then I was thinking to myself, well, I don't know, like, I guess I keep coming back to this idea that's related to the unified field theory that's of rationality, that's related to instrumental rationality. I just keep coming back to this idea that I'm not sure, again, that maybe this comes out of my belief in classical liberalism or my underpinnings of my beliefs in classical liberalism and the Enlightenment value, that I do believe that reasoning is a general lubricant to society, and that a rising tide lifts all boats. It can liberate people, it can help people. And I think that that's true both instrumentally in terms of the manifestation of rationality and science, scientific and technological advancement, and it's true in terms of discharging responsibilities in our own lives and our own communities. But I often wonder, because when Reed and I go around the world, I've probably said to him a million times, like, why can't we have nice things? Like, everywhere we go, I mean, like, Taiwan was just, like, spotless. Okay, you know, that's the other thing, I don't mean to be weird here. People constantly accuse me of being weird because I love to take pictures of toilets in public restrooms.
Okay, kind of weird, yeah.
Yeah, the reason, I do that for a reason. I do that because I think that the way people treat the commons, is vital. And I think it tells you so much about society. Like, you could go to Taiwan in the metros, in the train station, like the train station. I took pictures of their bathrooms. I could not believe how spotless they are. There's no graffiti. Nobody's committing social justice on the floor. The toilets are actually porcelain. They're not metal. They work. The doors open. It's London is very similar. Now, you know, in Austria, you have to pay a little bit. Those toilets are spotless. But it seems to me that we are a sick country, that we're marching toward hospice. I'm deeply concerned about it. You know, when I was in New York, I marveled at how many people jumped the turnstiles. Like, I simply couldn't believe it in New York City. And I told Andrew Doyle, my buddy Andrew Doyle, I'm like, dude, I could not believe how many people are jumping the turnstiles. I mean, the police were right there, they're jumping the turnstiles. He said, I've been living in London, you know, whatever he is, 40 or some odd years old. I've never seen a single person jump the turnstiles. Reed, we didn't see anybody jump the turnstiles, did we? I didn't see anybody jump the turnstiles. People are like civilized, like Hungary. You go to Hungary, you know how like...
And we have very different experiences in London, I think. I've been to London several times, but...
And how was that for you?
I feel like London is a pretty big... I feel like there's a lot of kind of crazy stuff. I didn't have a good experience with the bathrooms. A lot of places smell like piss.
Someone tried to steal my phone on a bike. They ran by on a bike and tried to pull the phone out of my hand.
Man, I don't know if I would say London is bad. It's not as bad as like a lot of the West Coast places in the U.S. Like
totally.
Seattle, L.A., San Francisco, but... But I understand in general what you're saying. Yeah, there does seem to be an issue. Yeah.
So just on that, so the I interviewed Matt Goodman and Eric Kaufman, and it seems insane to me. Their immigration policy is insane. It is literally ripping apart the sovereignty of their country. The crime rate, if you really drill down on the Eric Kaufman said something I've been thinking about that was so interesting to me. We tend to think of a kind of egalitarianism of contributions to the treasury. He said it is the evidence is overwhelming. Certain groups from certain regions of the world contribute to the treasury. Certain groups take out Indians, like from the country of India. Mm-hmm. They are radically disproportionate contributors to the treasury. Ashkenazi Jews, radically disproportionate. I'm not going to name the countries that aren't. But it seems fascinating to me. They're not willing to have a conversation about that. And if you're not willing to have a conversation, that gets back to the dialectic point again. Like, if you're not willing to have a conversation, if you're not willing to engage, which is the first question I asked you, is like, why are so many people on the left avoidant? Like, particularly if they're identitarians, like, why won't they come and talk about this? Is it because they're going to lose social cred? They don't actually believe what they believe. They don't want their beliefs challenged. They don't want to lose viewership. But when you're talking about societies and creating societies, it would seem to me that the indispensable condition for a flourishing society is you have to be willing to have a conversation with people you disagree with on an individual level. That doesn't have to be like on, you know, videoed or, but you have to be willing to have conversations with people, public debates and openness. And I don't see that in the US now, and that terrifies me.
Yeah, I think I kind of, I don't know if I say it doesn't happen in the US, we're definitely having more and more issues with it, but I definitely agree. I think there's something to be said for an adaptable system that's able to dynamically evaluate and adjust its inputs and outputs. I would argue, from a very limited perspective, because I'm not an economist, but I would argue that that was probably the chief reason why capitalism succeeded over socialism, is because in a capitalistic market, there are so many individual micro-autonomous agencies that can dynamically determine inputs and outputs to respond to conditions on the ground, that type of a system is always going to have so much more of an advantage over a centrally planned system. It's just impossible for a person to keep track of so many things. You need to be able to have a bunch of people that can adjust, but in order to adjust, I'm talking economically, but it could be ideologically, you need to be able to consider alternative things as opposed to what you have right now.
So let me throw this out to you. So you have a very large, very successful YouTube channel. We're growing our YouTube channel, Reads the brains behind the YouTube channel. We're growing that. But we've noticed recently, without any question whatsoever, we are being throttled. Like, and I asked two experts on this, everything just dramatically went down. Somebody is futzing with it. Since the game is like, we're playing by the rules and someone's manipulating. I wouldn't be surprised at all if this conversation was like, I don't know.
Okay.
Right. So I think one of the reasons you've been successful and Joe Rogan's been successful and the Trigonometry guys has been successful, I think it's because people are not, young people in particular, are not getting in the school systems what they need to get. Aristotle says all people want to know, basically the first line of the ethics. Like, we want to know, we want to understand, we're not being challenged, we're not being engaged. So they go to you, they go to Rogan, they go to other people to kind of get those conversations that they're not having. But now it seems that the rules are stacked against us. The system is, not the system, because that sounds like, I'm trying to say this without being conspiratorial, right? But it really is true. We're being fucked with by the algorithm. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't like our content, like what happened to Brett and Heather, independently of what you think of those claims about COVID. I don't know how to get over, maybe you go to an alternative platform like Rumble, but it has fewer people who view, I don't know how to get over it, but it's infuriating to me.
I would say the chance that an individual or somebody is intentionally turning down the channel is probably close to zero. I doubt that's happening.
Two people, I don't know anything about it, have told me that that's almost definitely the case, but go ahead.
Well, you can bring them on, I'll fight with them. But the idea of somebody, there are things that used to be able to cause it to happen. There are things that can cause it to happen if you're not aware of them, depending on how familiar you are with running a YouTube. Like I don't even know this anymore because I used to talk more with my editor, but he knows all this shit. But like, if you had like swear words in the first, like, I think like 1 minute of your YouTube video, then that'll deprioritize it a little bit because they're not pushing that.
You don't think it's a content? You don't think we're on a list somewhere of content?
I don't think. I think it just doesn't serve YouTube to do it. They're not going to make money doing it.
Unless it's ideological.
With the whole company, the boards and everybody that run Google just want to make money. The idea that they would sacrifice profits there for like some ideological adjustment.
We said that about Twitter. We've said that on NPR.
We could fight on Twitter on that, but I don't think it ever happened with Twitter either. I think that Twitter basically did what they thought they needed to do the whole time. I don't think that there was any crazy stuff happening there, but we could. I've done a lot of like the Twitter files. I've argued with a lot of those journalists actually over the Twitter files.
And you saw Schellenberger's report on that. And yep. Jack went before Congress. Are you de-boosted? Well, they defined it a different way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I won't dive too deeply into that, but I think that generally what happens if you're on a platform, unless you're like hitting, you're actually like striking things where they're saying that like, oh, we're throwing up a warning on this, or oh, this is like, you're getting community noted a lot on this or whatever. I think that generally it's just really hard for your style of content. The difficulty is going to be that people want to see like bombastic, exciting, like crazy things. And then longer form content is just really hard to do. So it's, it's really hard to put yourself in front of people.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm like so many people, I've lost complete confidence in our institutions. Mm-hmm. It's particularly legacy media. You know, the New York Times left off Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay's book, Cynical Theories. It clearly sold off. I think it's over 500,000 copies already. It left off Peterson's book. Mm-hmm. I just don't I don't know. So I don't know what to do about this YouTube thing. Mm-hmm. Or maybe there's nothing to do at all. I don't know.
Keep A-B testing, keep experimenting. Yeah, I could probably chat a little bit afterwards and see. But yeah, it's definitely, it is challenging, yeah.
So any final thoughts you want to give about anything, about life, the U.S., the world, our interview,
yourself? I wish people had like a little bit more room to kind of grow and explore without immediately being judged by everybody around them. I think that if we were a little bit more flexible and accepting of different viewpoints around us, I think we would all find ourselves like performing better and committing better to practices that get us to closer truthful positions rather than, you know, when somebody asks you a question, this like, well, what am I supposed to say based on who's around me? That kind of idea. Yeah.
And I think that's a friendship killer too.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
I mean, there are red lines, obviously, that we have. Maybe we could talk about what our red lines are for we're no longer friends with someone, but it seems to me to be largely crazy to end a friendship over a political dispute, like whether or not we should close the border.
I feel like it depends a lot.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
On what the issue is? Would you end a friendship with someone if they were radically, you know, against abortion or pro? I don't know, probably not. But the types of person who would have those dispositions in the first place, I might be less inclined to be friends with.
Potentially, that could be true. It's a lot of it is like self-selecting. But I'm just thinking of like, let's say that you are, like let's say you're a kid that came in on DACA and somehow you got citizenship and you're like a doctor now or a physician or whatever. And somebody's like, yeah, I think that all legal immigrants should be shipped away. I can understand that person. Like, I don't think I can be friends with you.
Yeah.
Or somebody who thinks that like, yeah, like I could imagine somebody who's like rabidly like anti-abortion and, you know, you happen to have either had an abortion or, you know, a woman who lived in a state where now it's impossible to get an abortion and she like died in childbirth and you're like, okay, well, fuck you. Like, I'm not going to be friends with you. I could imagine. The problem with saying, there's a big problem with the word politics or political, where politics ends up just meaning like anything I don't like or anything that's not important to me. Because really, it's almost impossible to divorce any particular idea or thought from a political one. So
Depends, yeah. Cool. Where can people find you?
YouTube.com/destiny, kick.com/destiny, Instagram.com/destiny. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for the conversation, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Good. Awesome. Thank you for watching. Everything we do is under the umbrella of the National Progress Alliance, nationalprogressalliance.org. It's a nonprofit, independent 501c3. Your generous donations keep us going and keep fueling content like this. So please help us out. Make a donation. We very much appreciate it. Thank you.